This is actually drawn from a chapter in a forthcoming book with Cornell University Press that'll be out in the spring, entitled History, Literature, Critical Theory, or These Are a Few of My Favorite Things. The approach to trauma, including its rendering in narrative, has long been accompanied by a paradox or a double bind. The traumatic experience is unspeakable, yet calls for endless speech. This uncannily familiar situation is well evoked in the Wittgensteinian subtitle of a book by two French psychoanalysts, the subtitle being, Whereof One Cannot Speak, Thereof One Cannot Stay Silent, which is of course a twist on the last sentence of Wittgenstein's Tractatus. The similarities and differences between not only testimonies, but all attempts to address or, quote, represent traumatic experience and events are determined, I think, by the manner in which this paradox or double bind is negotiated. From the aporetic gaps and muted signs of seemingly symptomatic performance to the attempts at some articulation of or work on and through problems in ways that may intensify or at times mitigate the haunting presence of the past. It's an understatement to say that this paradox is extensively explored in the text of W.G. Sebald, Winfried Georg, known as Max Sebald. Sebald is, in his own view, a member of a generation born later, coming after the perpetration of atrocities and living in the aftermath and the heavy shadow of events he did not directly perpetrate, but for which he nonetheless bears a sense of responsibility, if not guilt. Better stated, an anxiety-ridden, rather bewildering disquiet that concepts such as responsibility and guilt, as well as more ritualized concepts such as stain, tend to localize in a questionable fashion. Recently, the Holocaust and colonialism have been related historically and analytically in various ways. Perhaps most pointedly in the argument that colonialism, especially in conjunction with racism, may have paralleled and at times prepared for the Nazi genocide. This argument may, of course, raise doubts about the concept of uniqueness and its analogs when applied to the Holocaust as being overly Eurocentric. They generally emerge from a Eurocentric context. And for related observations, I direct you to a couple of books, one very interesting, still very controversial book, by Olivier Lecourt-Grandmaison. The book entitled Coloniser, Exterminer, not translated, Colonize, Exterminate. And also the very well-documented book of my colleague Isabel Hull entitled Absolute Destruction on the genocidal attempt in West Germany against the Herero in 1904, as well as related events. And you could go into other instances that people have very forcefully argued are genocidal. Sebald is most insistently affected by the Nazi genocide or Holocaust, the latter term he tends not to use. But his texts also show a concern with colonialism and its aftermath, as well as with the abusive treatment of non-human animals. And one issue we can go into is the very fraught issue of terminology, for example, in quote-unquote Holocaust studies. And I think it's an interesting issue. And also the issue of uniqueness is an interesting issue. Sebald's style has an understated quality, even when addressing issues evoking hyperbole. One aspect of the uncanniness of his text is this subdued stylistic unsettlement in the face of the excessive and overwhelming. Sebald at times seems to be a student of Kafka, among other predecessors, notably, at least for my purposes, Flaubert and Benjamin. Someone who's undertaken archival research both in documents and in the recesses of memory. Sebald may perhaps be seen as representing one crucial melancholic mutation in the lineage of Flaubert. For example, in terms of experimentation in the combination of formal innovation with actual or invented documentation. Documentation that is at times carried to the disorienting point of a mania, paralleling or even enacting what is seen as the maniacally catastrophic events of history. One may, of course, mention other figures in relation to Zabel, some of whom he mentions himself, such as Thomas Bernhard, but I'll simply add the name of Thomas Mann. I think Mann is one of the writers whom Zabel attends to and, in a sense, rewrites. In his 1999 Natural History of Destruction, which is a rather strange translation of Luftkrieg und Literatur, which is aerial bombing and literature, he makes a comment about the reading of Dr. Faustus that has a kind of self-referential twist. Quote, in Dr. Faustus, Thomas Mann wrote a comprehensive historical criticism of an art that was increasingly inclined to take an apocalyptic view of the world, at the same time confessing his own involvement. These are all very self-referential. Most of his statements about others are also self-referential. It's likely that few of the readers for whom this novel was originally intended understood him. The lava barely cold under their feet, they were too preoccupied with the reaffirmation of their higher ideals, too anxious to free themselves of any taint. They did not go deeply into the complex question of the relationship between ethics and aesthetics that tormented Thomas Mann. I think the latter point brings up the way Zabel is occupied, even preoccupied, by ethics, aesthetics, history, and I would add, the question of realism, indeed traumatic realism, but in relation to formal techniques and various distancing devices without which literature would not be literary. Yet what may be most interesting, at least for me, is the way a mutual pressure is exerted, at times to the near breaking point, between the demands of historical and sociopolitical reality on the one hand, and the exigencies of form and formal experimentation on the other. Whatever the shifting sands between history and literary form may be in Zabel, the movement is not fixed by a rigid boundary marker or a notion of discrete realms. Zabel may employ an associative, at times a dreamlike linkage of fact and fiction, but his conjunctions are never simple amalgamations, and texts that may be weighted in one direction or another will leave the reader off balance concerning their genre. The inserted, seemingly documentary black and white photograph or graphic is the most blatant instance of the archival artifact in a Zabel text. But its function is never simply documentary, and the reading of text and photograph may create both a sense of mutually informative signification and a puzzlement, at times evoking vertigo, to use the title of his first long prose work, published in 1990. Zabel states that 90% of his photographs, at least in The Emigrants of 1992, are authentic, but that makes the reader uncertain about the other 10%. As you may recall, The Emigrants begins with a photo of a cemetery and then turns without transition to a description of an old, overgrown country house in which Zabel, or the Zabel narrator, and his partner, Clara, here, his wife was actually named Uta, rent an apartment. The book ends with a precise description of three women in the Lodz ghetto working at a loom, analogized to the parquet or fates, but upsets expectations by providing no photograph. So a crassus here without photograph. The self-implicating Zabel narrator, who we're told stands in the exact same spot as the photographer did, taking this photograph, wonders what were the names of these women, who the reader assumes were Jewish and did not survive the genocide. The Emigrants, I think, might be read as a rejoinder to Edgar Wright's epical TV series of 1984, in that Zabel focuses not on the Alltagsgeschichte of ordinary Germans, for whom Jews and their existence were a marginal or marginalized concern, but rather on the desperate afterlife of traumatized emigrants, notably Jews. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into anything like an analysis of the immigrants, including the one non-Jew, interestingly, given a fictitious name, but Zebalt's great uncle, who, like some of us here today, committed himself to an insane asylum in Ithaca, New York. not only because of the graphic elements, but also the frequent, at times abrupt, segues and detours, the eye and the mind confronted with a page of Zebalt does not know where to settle. And the reader is both fascinated and distracted by various modalities of juxtaposition. Narrative flow is disrupted, shards of often enigmatic, at times traumatic actuality are inserted. And here, one may recall, I think one of the most disturbing, for me, images of Zebalt in Zebalt is in the Rings of Saturn, where you have this incredible heap of herring surrounded by a group of men, which evokes all sorts of connotations. And the reader's train of thought, like Zebalt's, may wander along associative paths and the byways of essayistic ruminations, evoked by traces of the past, with closure becoming all the more elusive. Another semi-autobiographical comment Zebalt makes about the appeal of photographs is worth quoting, since it offers, I think, non-reductive insight into his orientation towards the past and its dead. And this is, I think, a rather, comes from The Emergence of Memory, which I think is a really interesting book, collection of essays on and interviews with Zebalt. The Emergence of Memory, which I think is really something that would fascinate any reader. And here's the quote. Death entered my own life at a very early point. I grew up in a very small village, very high up in the Alps in Bavaria, about 3,000 feet above sea level. And in the immediate post-war years when I grew up there, it was in many ways quite an archaic place. For instance, you couldn't bury the dead in the winter because the ground was frozen and there was no way of digging it up. So you had to leave them in the woodshed for a month or two until the thaw came. You grew up with this knowledge that death is around you. And when and if someone died, it happened in the middle or center of the house, as it were. The dead person went through their agonies in the living room, and then before the burial, they would still be part of the family for possibly 3 or 4 days. So I was, from a very early point on, very familiar, much more familiar than people are nowadays, with the dead and the dying. I've always had at the back of my mind this notion, which is quite recurrent in Zebalt, that of course these people aren't really gone. They just hover somewhere at the perimeter of our lives and keep coming in on brief visits. And photographs are, for me, as it were, one of the emanations of the dead, especially these older photographs of people no longer with us. Nevertheless, through these pictures, they do have what seems to me to be some sort of spectral presence. And I've always been intrigued by that. It's got nothing to do with the mystical or the mysterious. It's just a remnant of a much more archaic way of looking at things. Hence, for Zebalt, the heralded indexicality of the photograph is itself ghostly, but presumably not mysterious or mystical, for it emanates from the dead and is the medium of a spectral, absent presence. I would say, just as in the case of the Zebalt narrator, a kind of photographic negative with respect especially to Jacques Austerlitz, for example. Austerlitz, his last long published work, which came out in 2001, and he was killed in an automobile accident in December of the same year. And Austerlitz, the unnamed, spectral, seemingly Zebalt-like narrator, has the closest proximity to Austerlitz, whom he accidentally meets a number of times over the years, to whom he attentively listens, and whose story he empathically recounts, punctuated by Austerlitz's traumatic discovery or recovery of his Jewish background and the fate of his parents at the hands of the Nazis. At least one prominent role played by Zebalt as writer is that of the witness simultaneously to history and to the contemporary challenges and possibilities of literature. His writing is not restricted to bearing witness and giving testimony, but he's nonetheless compellingly called and even caught by the insistence of the real, both the historically real and less determinate trans-historical Lacanian real, the presumably decentering, shattering void at the center of existence. He's also more than mindful of the at times playful possibilities and pitfalls of his calling as writer. I'd also maintain that in his text, the witness does not stand in for the dead god or sublime seer and assume a prophetic or martyr-like voice. His writing, what he terms simply a form of prose fiction, tends to be difficult to classify, I think notably in terms of the opposition between the secular and the religious, or even in terms of the more recent notion of the post-secular. Issues in and around the religious, the spiritual, and the post-secular are seriously or playfully broached, but the approach remains tentative, exploratory, and at times ironically inflected. Indeed, Zabalt often explicitly resists religious or, quote, mystical appropriation. It's interesting, interview he does say that he is very interested in metaphysical questions, and he thinks this is what differentiates his work from that of historians. He also says, interestingly, that he really doesn't see himself as a writer. He sees his work as obsessive and devotional, which again is very interesting as a self-description. Zabalt has been taken in post-secular directions, notably in Eric L. Santner's On Creaturely Life. In reading Zabalt, one can sense the appeal of this approach, and in general, value the sustained attentiveness evident in Santner's insights, a quality he himself values highly in Zabalt. Even if one questions, as I would, a perhaps overly restrictive linkage of Zabalt with the German-Jewish tradition, importantly including Franz Rosenzweig for Santner, a tradition that had an evident appeal for Kafka, Benjamin, and Santner himself. Rosenzweig is really not, I think, a reference for Zabalt. Without in any sense denying the importance of Kafka and Benjamin for Zabalt, I nonetheless reiterate the point that, as Santner well realizes, the forces bearing on Zabalt's work render it overdetermined, including the role of a great many non-Jewish writers, some of whom I've mentioned, Flaubert, Mann, you could add Nabokov, you could add Borges, you could add a number of others, as well as of historical phenomena, notably the Nazi genocide, colonialism, and such diffuse processes as rampant destruction, victimization, and abuse, including the treatment of animals. Moreover, the evanescent epiphanic moment or opening in Zabalt often seems to be the tenuous accompaniment of a sense of extreme disempowerment and near fatalistic melancholy, at times bordering on despair. A source of this prevalent sense or mood is what Zabalt takes as the entropic course of history that subsides via its mounting ruins into the cycles of nature. Here it would be Benjamin's Angel of History, seen as a traumatized, bewildered, immobilized witness, propelled by the blowback of a catastrophic history, a post-traumatically disordered spectral spectator, more than the messianic intimations, the momentary attempts to redeem the commodity, and the problematic intersections with Jewish mysticism that would appear to be Zabalt's Saturnine muse. Here it would be extremely interesting to compare and contrast in the old formulation Zabalt with Jane Bennett, who was mentioned yesterday, especially in The Enchantment of Modern Life. Similar problems in and around the post-secular, very divergent directions. That's something we might talk about because it is interesting. To recur to another Benjaminian topos, runes, or perhaps better, rubble, not romantic runes, but rubble, from catastrophes, form the incline path from history or culture to nature that is also ruined. Or as Abel himself puts it in a rather deflationary, decidedly non-prophetic passage, I think Benjamin at one point says that there is no point in exaggerating that which is already horrific. This is not nice, but somebody might tweet that to Agamben. At least, at least on my reading of Remnants of Auschwitz. And from that, by extrapolation, one could conclude that perhaps in order to get the full measure of the horrific, one needs to remind the reader of beatific moments in life. Because if you existed solely with your imagination in le monde concentrationnaire, then you would somehow not be able to sense it. And so it requires that contrast. The old-fashionedness of the diction or of the narrative tone are, have therefore nothing to do with nostalgia for a better state or an age long gone, but is simply something that, as it were, heightens the awareness of that which we have managed to engineer in this century. Unquote. In his interesting essay on Sebald in Inner Workings, Literary Essays 2000 to 2005, J.M. Coetzee debatably states that, quote, The Rings of Saturn, 1995, comes the closest among Sebald's books to what we usually think of as nonfiction. It's written to tame the paralyzing horror that overtakes its author, that is to say, its eye figure, in the face of the decline of the eastern region of England and the destruction of its landscape. Sebald taught for some 25, 30 years at the University of East Anglia and lived in that area in England. Coetzee goes on to point out parenthetically that, of course, the eye in Sebald's books is not to be identified with the historical W.G. Sebald. Nevertheless, Sebald as author plays mischievously with similarities between the two, to the point of reproducing snapshots and passport photographs of Sebald in his texts, unquote. It's noteworthy that of course, dismisses simple identification is followed immediately by a nevertheless. I think Coetzee here points to the proximity, or perhaps what you might call the distortive similarity, but not the identity, of author, writer, and narrator, even at times character. Not only the shifting first-person Sebald narrator in The Rings of Saturn or The Emigrants, but the somewhat more differentiated Jacques Austerlitz, from whom the Sebald narrator nonetheless often seems to have the minimal distance of a diaphanous medium. One might perhaps read the title, The Rings of Saturn, in terms of an endless journey or ambulatory writing pilgrimage that circles melancholically and at times dizzyingly around the ruins of history and its sediments in contemporary life. He even says at one point, interestingly, that as a kid he thought that rubble was the natural state of cities. This repetitive circling, with the narrator often in a twilight state between waking and dreaming, has no dialectical impetus or movement of overcoming, much less redemption. It's at most broken by uncanny, evanescent epiphanies, such as that provided by the momentary appearance of a duck, of rays of sun, quote, making a fan-shaped pattern as they descended, of the sort that used to appear in religious pictures, symbolizing the presence of grace or providence, or even the almost supernatural apparition of a pimp in a white suit, wearing a gold-frame eyeglasses and a ludicrous Tyrolean hat. But the epiphanies are momentary, or may even seem like parodic pop-ups, sort of pop-up epiphanies, there in an instant and gone, and you're wondering, was this really an epiphany? And a state of grace or a providential presence is at best a thing of the past, whose modern residues do not come trailing clouds of glory. The writer's own textual labor is analogized to the torturous activity of the silk weaver, or even the silk worm, which is discussed in manifold ways, from the ruthless cruelty of the Dowager Empress Xu Shi of China, who had daily blood sacrifices offered to the gods of silk, to the use of silkworms by the Nazis, including their snow-white relation to the best and cleanest of all possible worlds, and the extermination of the worms in a killing operation by suspending cocoons over boiling water for upwards of 3 hours. At one point, the narrator observes that, quote, my rational mind is nonetheless unable to lay the ghosts of repetition that haunt me with ever greater frequency. And in post-traumatic fashion, he approximates the disorienting feeling of numbness to that of repetition, wondering whether repetition is some kind of anticipation of the end, a venture into the void. Animals make frequent appearances in Zabel, but I think they are, for the most part, treated as aspects of a consuming vision of ecological disaster, both man-made and quasi-fatalistic. And when they appear in more discrete and relational terms, it's often in a deranged or demented state brought about by human abuse. Prototypical here is the captive, obsessive-compulsive raccoon, of which the Zabel narrator near the beginning of Austerlitz remarks, the only animal which has remained lingering in my memory is the raccoon. I watched it for a long time as it sat beside a little stream with a serious expression on its face, washing the same piece of apparel over and over again, as if it hoped that all this washing, which went far beyond any reasonable thoroughness, would help it to escape the unreal world in which it had arrived, so to speak, through no fault of its own. I've intimated that Zabel's own narrative practice might at least at times be seen as analogous to that of the raccoon. In light of its seemingly compulsive, repetitive descriptions of hopeless scenes from the perspective of a contemplative yet disconcerted bystander, listener, or onlooker. In a sense, a benumbed, incapacitated witness at the dilapidated, even shell-shocked zoo of history. And I note that captivity in zoos is one problem that eats away at Zabel, including his account in the Natural History of Destruction of the effect of bombing on animals in zoos, which is really dreadful. This impression of transfixed, often horrified witnessing is intensified by the juxtaposition on facing pages of two photographs in framing large animal eyes, seemingly a raccoon's and an owl's, or maybe two types of owl, with one set of eyes strangely much larger than the other. And along with his two sets of clipped human eyes, one apparently Wittgenstein's, and the other of an older man, presumably Jan Peter Tripp, a friend of Zabel, and a very well-known painter. Wittgenstein repeated the proverbial saying that the eyes are the windows of the soul. And here the eyes seem to reflect nothing. Yet Zabel's descriptions of animals are hauntingly compelling, and they may well evoke an empathic response in the reader, or even induce the reader to see other animals not as mere objects of use, or even as abject recipients of divinely delegated, at times merciful, human dominion, but as making both demands for non-abusive treatment and claims for justice that have typically gone unheeded. And Zabel's own stylistic repetition of repetition, of course, introduces variations that are not simply symptoms and may even counteract compulsiveness at least to a limited degree. With reference to Tripp, Jan Peter Tripp, I'll make a brief detour to note that in the essay, An Attempt at Restitution, and interestingly, he uses the word Restitution in German. It's not something like Wiedergutmachung. He actually uses this word, restitution, included in an essay in the collection Campo Santo, a very interesting collection, came out in 2003 posthumously. Zabel provides this fascinating insight into what he calls his method of procedure, which of course you may question in certain ways. Here's the quote. In May 1976, Jan Peter Tripp gave me a present of one of his engravings, showing the mentally ill judge, Daniel Paul Schreiber, with a spider in his skull. What can there be more terrible than the ideas always scurrying in our minds? And much of what I've written derives from this engraving, even in my method of procedure, in adhering to an exact historical perspective, in patiently engraving and linking together apparently disparate things in the manner of a still life, unquote. You can question a number of aspects of this, but you could certainly find the necessity of qualifying the reference to a still life by pointing out the role of repetition with its relation to belated temporality, trauma, and its aftermath that is so pronounced in Zabel's treatment of time and narrative. Or as he puts it, interestingly, in an interview, when the narrative is finished, its beginnings show up in a new light. I mean, after the talk becomes tick again, which would be a great title for a book or an essay, after the talk becomes tick again, a narrative procedure. In writing The Rings of Saturn, one may be reminded of the later Flaubert, but it's Joseph Conrad, especially in his relation to Roger Casement, who inter alia receives extended treatment. Zabel apparently feels an affinity not only with Flaubert, but also with the Pole, who wrote in English and retained a Polish accent, and had an uncomfortable relation to both his, quote, native and his adopted cultures, as well as an apprehensive sense of a, quote, guilt-ridden colonial enterprise, an implication in an adult history that Zabel seems to understand as similar to his own relation to the Nazi past. Zabel refers a few times to Conrad by his anglicized name, but then turns in a telling alienation effect to the Polish Kwasniewski. He asserts that the madness of the whole colonial enterprise was gradually brought home to Kwasniewski. He adds that during his journey, Kwasniewski began to grasp that his own travails did not absolve him from the guilt he had incurred by his mere presence in the Congo, which may, I think, downplay the involvement and the relative lack of active political resistance in Conrad's relation to a nonetheless criticized Belgian colonialism. He was a supporter of British imperialism, of course. Zabel notes as well that, quote, back in Leopoldville, Kwasniewski was so sick in body and in soul that he longed for death. What was to be another 3 months before this man, whose protracted bouts of despair were henceforth to alternate with his writing, was able to depart homeward from Africa. And this again is self-referential. Zabel typically had breakdowns between his periods of writing. Roger Casement may be an even more pronounced object of Zabel's empathic interest, if not identification. His depiction of Casement is strongly etched and forceful, stressing the importance of Casement's trenchantly critical report on the Congo and his, quote, unconditional partisanship for the victims and those who had no rights. He also stresses Casement's espousal of the oppressed, not only in Africa, but in Britain, with respect to the, quote, white Indians of Ireland. He notes that Casement's homosexuality, which was an embarrassment for many Irish partisans, may well have, quote, sensitized him to the continuing oppression, exploitation, enslavement, and destruction across the borders of class and race of those who were furthest from the centers of power. Zabel concludes his own discussion of Casement by noting dryly that Casement was, as expected, found guilty of high treason and hung, and the remains of his body exhumed from a lime pit in 1965 were presumably scarcely identifiable any longer. Earlier in this section, Zabel asks with respect to the dead in the Battle of Waterloo, evoked by the Lion Monument in Belgium, are we standing on a mountain of death? Is that our ultimate vantage point? Does one really have the much vaunted historical overview from such a position? Perhaps an even better candidate for the status of nonfiction in Zabel is the collection of critical essays in the book translated as The Natural History of Destruction. This bitterly elegiac history in the mode of endless lament most approaches a muted concept of working through the traumas and disasters of the past in its discussion of Alexander Kluge, closest to some notion of working through the past in the discussion of Alexander Kluge, only to swerve away from Kluge in an insistence on the futility of hope and the irreparable nature of history. And I quote again, and he's referring here to Kluge's Unheimlichkeit der Zeit, Despite Kluge's ironic style, the prospect suggested here of an alternative historical outcome, possible in specific circumstances, is a serious call to work for the future in defiance of all calculations of probability. A very powerful formulation. Central to Kluge's detailed description of the social organization of disaster, which is pre-programmed by the ever-recurrent and ever-intensifying errors of history, is the idea that a proper understanding of the catastrophes we're always setting off is the first prerequisite for the social organization of happiness. However, it is difficult to dismiss the idea that the systematic destruction Kluge sees arising from the development of the means and modes of industrial production hardly seems to justify the principle of hope." Unquote. One might ask why Zabolt refers to the principle of hope, the term of Ernst Bloch, or even the somewhat sinister social organization of happiness, when defiant determination against the odds would seem more in keeping with his own account of Kluge's thought. Later in the text, Zabolt seems close to Peter Weiss, whom he discusses at times in a participatory, if not projective, manner, emphasizing more than Weiss himself the latter's Jewish background, and insisting on, quote, the endemic perversion of cruelty inherent in the history of mankind that cannot be redeemed in the last chapter, since our species is unable to learn from its mistakes. Arguably paying insufficient attention to the role of resistance, including political resistance, in Weiss, what Zabolt detects in Weiss's aesthetic of resistance is not only the expression of an ephemeral wish for redemption, but an expression of the will to be on the side of the victims at the end of time, unquote. Indeed, Zabolt's own perspective in The Natural History of Destruction, which at times uses the same seemingly amalgamating terminology of annihilation, Vernichtung, and disaster for the German victims of aerial bombing and for the Jewish and other victims of the Nazi genocide, however much open to question on the level of historical and critical analysis, as I think it is, may be understood as the way the past might well be subjectively experienced by a German born later whose inclination was to align himself with the victim. Here I'd note that in one of the strongest critiques of Zabolt's work, Ruth Franklin finds in it the aestheticization of history, the elision of the causes of phenomena, the confusion of human action with natural processes, and in The Natural History of Destruction, the conflation of German suffering with that of Jews in a way that creates, quote, the suspicion of moral equivalency. And I'd refer you to her essay, The Rings of Smoke, first published in The New Republic in 2002, and then also in this, collected in this this volume, The Emergence of Memory, edited by Lynn Sharon Schwartz, coming out rather recently. There are indeed elements of fatalism, or I think it's correlative, the role of chance and coincidence, as well as a tendency to collapse natural processes and human action in Zabolt. I think you could ask whether there is a similar tendency on a microbiological level in the recent prevalent notion of autoimmunity as applied to human societies. One could go into that if you like, whether the notion of autoimmunity also is a quasi-fatalistic microbiological conception of society, often in insufficiently mediated ways. Yet on the level of what Franklin sees as causes, Zabolt obviously believed, I think correctly, that the nature and extent of the bombing of German cities at the end of the war was far in excess of what was necessary to defeat the Nazis. And as Franklin intimates, it's difficult to accuse of moral equivalency, a confused term in any case, someone who addressed the atrocities or the aftermath of the Nazi genocide at times in elusive, conflicted, or confused ways, as in The Natural History of Destruction, but often in an explicit, extensive, and even obsessive fashion. And it's also interesting that in responding to critiques that were made of his initial delivery of certain lectures in the at Zurich, in the book Luftkrieg in Literatur, he also goes to the opposite extreme of saying that we Germans brought the bombing of our cities on ourselves, which really is the other extreme. In commenting on the final image of the Parkhager fates and the emigrants, Franklin, a child of Holocaust victims and survivors, observes that one young woman in the photograph, quote, could have been my own grandmother, who was blonde and whose family owned a textile factory in Lodz. In a manner that may create the impression of an underestimation of blankness as an aesthetic strategy, or even of a movement towards sacralization and taboo, I think reminiscent of Claude Lanzmann, Franklin accuses Zabalt of substituting an artistic image for a blank space, where the blankness is, however, closer to the truth. Her analysis ends with a curious comment that may seem to repeat the kind of amalgamating terminology with respect to the Holocaust that she justifiably criticizes Zabalt for employing. The art he created is of near miraculous beauty, but it is as fragile and as ephemeral as a pearl of smoke. A rather strange analogy when you're criticizing amalgamating terminology with respect to the Holocaust. Zabalt's work, almost unbelievable beauty and like a pearl of smoke. However, with Ruth Franklin and others, one could make the case that a focus, if not a fixation, of Zabalt's work is the apprehension of what is to come after history. As the world subsides in seemingly fatalistic fashion into the post-histoire brought about by massive destruction, be it that of aerial bombing of German cities or the Nazi genocide, and annihilation of Jews and other groups. Indeed, Zabalt's perspective combines extreme precision with respect to historical details and a trans-historical sense of a vortex-like consumption of history in a movement or retrovirus of devastating catastrophe. What might be seen as the plummeting of historical reality into the black hole of the traumatic Lacanian real. And this is not unique to Zabalt. Zabalt might even be seen as rewriting Walter Benjamin's Trauerspiel book, with mourning explicitly and insistently becoming impossible, and even looping back into endless interminable melancholy. Precision of detail would almost seem not to invite, but instead to foreclose the type of specificity that might both test trans-historical apprehensions and at times even indicate, as he himself intimates in the discussion of Kluge, the possibility of locating or generating alternatives to the one-way journey backward of the angel of history. I refer to Zabalt's momentary epiphanies or beatific breaks in the clouds, which, however much read against the grain, may facilitate his appropriation for post-secular readings that insist on the pervasiveness of trauma, catastrophe, haunting, and compulsive repetition, yet also point to the messianic chips of time that fleetingly and accidentally present themselves in an altogether aleatory fashion. Acts of grace or gratuitous acts that might themselves be seen from a less ecstatic or more doubting perspective, not only as necessary points of contrast, but also as symptomatic complements of despair and disempowerment. The latter estimation would seem close to Coetzee's, when he notes towards the end of his essay that Zabalt's discussion in his long poem After Nature of a painting, Altdorf's Battle of Arbela, discloses a panorama of slaughter on a huge scale, rendered in detail of hallucinatory, vertigo-inducing minuteness. Indeed, the painting ought to precipitate another of his melancholic collapses. Instead, it leads to the rather unconvincing transcendence with which the poem ends. Clouds opening and so forth, sun. Here, Coetzee seems to see unconvincing transcendence as an empty utopia. Yet it is, of course, consubstantial with the accidental, aleatory epiphany that it appear utterly arbitrary and comes miraculously, like a certain form of divine grace, when it will, not when we will. It may never seem convincing, but it may be compelling to a certain kind of melancholic, messianic sensibility, which I think is more the exception than the rule in Zabal, at least in terms of the Messianic. My severely truncated account, which I'm sure is starting to seem very long, but I assure you it's very truncated, my account implies that it would be a mistake to see Zabal simply as a melancholic bricoleur, despite the importance of melancholia and parataxis in his approach. I think this is often, for example, the very interesting and good book of Roger Luckhurst, The Trauma Question, which I'd recommend. I think, is maybe too summary in his judgment that Zabal seems interested only in the psychology of melancholic entrapment, and ultimately seems to become a traumatophile. And that hurts to be called a traumatophile. And I'd simply note that the emphasis on melancholia often comes with an aesthetic of the sublime. And I would say that in Zabal you find something like an aesthetic of sobriety, to use a term that Franz Hofer is here has employed, and a kind of critique of an indiscriminate aesthetic of the sublime. The complexity of Zabal's understanding of melancholia and his critical orientation to dubious, not all, conceptions of mourning and working through is particularly evident in what might be seen as a key text, not only concerning its ostensible objects, but also with respect to Zabal himself. And the text to which I'm referring is included in the book Campo Santo and entitled Constructs of Mourning, Gunter Grass and Wolfgang Hildesheimer, Grass and Hildesheimer. Zabal's preference for Hildesheimer is unmistakable, but his reasons are simultaneously historical and literary, perhaps ethical and political as well. He views Grass in terms similar to those he applies to others in the so-called Gruppe 47, Group 47, particularly Alfred Andersch, whom he scathingly treats and implicitly contrasts with Jean Améry. And he actually discovers this fortress of Brindach, which is so important in Rings of Saturn, as he's working on Améry and locates the place where Améry was tortured. It's a very interesting aside to people who may not know this. You can find it by looking up Alison Fraser, who's written a very interesting article on Machiavelli, pointing out that just before he wrote The Prince, Machiavelli underwent the same torture as Améry, say, arms tied behind your back and being brought up until your muscles gave way and your bones cracked. Zabal did not know of Grass's belatedly acknowledged participation as a very young man in the Waffen-SS. Still, Grass for Zabal obscured, quote, the real aspects of the story of the Danzig Jews in his 1974 Diary of a Snail. Most significantly, Zabal observes in Constructs of Mourning that Grass's, quote, snail-like theme of melancholy functions as an alibi to counter the programmatic intention of mourning, which would be necessary to engage the history of Danzig's Jews. So here one has a realization of the limitations of melancholy and the stress on melancholia, and an historiographical, ethical, and political defense of mourning for victims, a critical theoretical defense, which is neither redemptive nor primarily psychological. And I would add a perspective on mourning that I share. And I'd also add that unlike melancholia, mourning, while of course having an affective dimension, is not primarily an affect or a mood. You might argue that melancholy is an affect or a mood, but mourning is not primarily an affect or a mood. It's a social and even a ritual process, possibly with a political side as well. And that's something one could go into, which is, I think, too infrequently recognized. And with respect to mourning, one might include the laughter of the wake as an important form, if not prototype, of gallows humor. And I would say there's a lot of interesting humor and gallows humor in Zabal, which I don't have time to go into, that Santner does discuss in his own way on Creaturely Life. By contrast, Zabal reads Hildesheimer's Tinset of 1965, Tinset, T-Y-N-S-E-T, a place name. He reads Hildesheimer's Tinset of 1965 as an allegory of the Nazi genocidal treatment of Jews, and finds in its experimental paratactic techniques the echoes of post-traumatic effects. Hildesheimer, not a Holocaust survivor, was Jewish and, interestingly, a translator at the Nuremberg trials. Zabalt even finds that Tinset, quote, seems to have been created from the heart of mourning itself. And he pinpoints in the text, which Hildesheimer refused to call a novel, rituals poised between melancholy and mourning that provide some relief, but not release or salvation. Rituals such as the narrator's nocturnal reading of telephone directories and timetables, as well as his dreams of a country beyond Dürer's Sea of Melancholia. Zabel notes that the first-person narrator of Tinset's lengthy monologue is, quote, never clearly perceived as a character, only as a voice, and that following trails of complicity and fellow traveling that emerge from his random telephone calls, he conveys to upright fellow citizens messages so urgent that they leave home in haste. And the obvious thing here, he's telling them about their past, things they don't want to hear. Zabel doesn't make the seemingly obvious point that the directories and timetables may also be repeatedly read by the insomniac ambulatory narrator to note and commemorate what had been murdered, mutilated, destroyed, and distorted in the Nazi past. Zabel insists that, quote, we are dealing here with something far from nihilism in the usual sense. It's more like an approximation to death, to which melancholy clings, quoting Tinset, like the fat weed that roots itself in ease on Lethe Wharf, a provocative gesture of resignation. Comparing Hildesheimer to Kafka, he adds that the area that melancholy thus sets out to explore stretches out before us in the castle, in Kafka's The Castle, as a snowy, frozen landscape. And its exact counterpart is Tinset, a place in the north of Norway that the narrator ventures to visit. Tinset is the penultimate stage on his journey. After it comes Røros, R-O-umlaut, R-O-S, Røros, which, quoting Tinset, lies like a last camp on the way to the end of the world. Before that way is lost in inhospitable regions, a territory so incalculable, so menacing, that its exploration has been postponed year after year, until the camp has become the eternal autumn quarters inhabited by aging explorers, who have lost sight of their goal, have forgotten it, and now look vaguely for the geographical origins of a melancholy, origins that they have long been seeking, but on which they can never lay hands. I think something that could conceivably be read as an allegory or commentary on the contemporary left. I'd add that it's appropriate, if ironic, that Røros may be very close to the Svalbard, not the Zabalt, but the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, or Doomsday Vault, near the North Pole in Norway, which is the post-apocalyptic multinational repository of seeds that presumably may restart vegetation in the wake of a world-destroying catastrophe. Zabalt himself, in this essay in Campo Santo, resists the almost overwhelming temptation to embrace fatalism and melancholy, but instead traces the unfixed interactions between a marked Saturnine response, which for many has become his distinctive signature, and its intricate links to forms of mourning that do not bring either closure or redemption, but nonetheless have a necessary but not sufficient role in working through the relations between past, present, and future. And since I am just on time, I have something else to add, if you give me a few more minutes, which is sort of interesting about reception. It's brief, and it's interesting, I think, about reception. And it's a different note as an ending. The reception of Zabel's texts in different contexts, including the English-speaking world, where they have often been celebrated. If you read the comments, I mean, the comments are just mind-boggling. Indeed, seen by some, more than some, including Susan Sontag, as sublime. This question of reception is beyond the scope of my analysis. Still, I'd like to say a couple of things. I'd note that, and Max Penske, who's in the audience, just gave me a very interesting article he's published recently on Heidegger, Benjamin, and Zabel, which I'd strongly recommend. I note that in the German context, Zabel's orientation may seem untimely, more reminiscent of important currents in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, culminating in certain respects in the heated historikerstreit, or historians' debate, in 1986. These currents resisted the normalization of the Nazi past and the neoconservative forces with which normalization was often allied. Instead, they emphasized the way the Nazi genocide had to remain an open wound, or if it allowed for any significant healing, mourning, or working through, the process had to resist closure and to eventuate at most in scars that were not only visible, but insistently pronounced and even disfiguring. In important ways, certain views expressed by Jürgen Habermas epitomize this orientation, and I think you also find it in the recent work of Saul Friedlander, Nazi Germany and the Jews. In the more recent past, different problems have arisen, notably with respect to the German context, that have arguably changed certain terms of the debate. While extreme neoconservatism and even neo-fascism are not simply things of the past, still the post-historikerstreit generation has seen the prevalence of both commemoration and memory work, even leading to debatable concerns about a surfeit or excess of memory and a transnational trauma or victim culture. Concerns that I think are at best overblown. We can talk about that if you like. One resulting problem is how to approach the Nazi past in a manner that continues to raise questions for, while not overwhelming or imputing guilt to a generation born much later, that however well informed may be either confused by or feel distanced, if not detached from, a past that nonetheless refuses to pass away. And one available response is, of course, this has nothing to do with me. Let's turn the page. Let's walk away. And I've heard this, I must say, more than once from younger people, from not only Germany, but other areas. To the extent the foregoing brief analysis is pertinent, it might be taken to indicate one possible set of reference points for the elaboration of Zabel's own concerns. One could, for example, point to an aesthetic of sobriety, quite different from an indiscriminate aesthetic of the sublime. One could also point to the insistence on documentation that, along with an aesthetic of sobriety, Zabel shares with advocates of the memory site as a place of informed critical reflection, embodied in the Berlin site, the topography of terror, especially with respect to members of Zabel's own generation, including the important historian Reinhard Rorup, R-U-U-M-L-A-U-T, and Dieter Hoffmann-Axthelm, A-X-T-H-E-L-M. Dieter Hoffmann-Axthelm. The latter a very early advocate of drawing attention and critical awareness to the Gestapo Gelände in Berlin that had been abandoned, largely forgotten, and left in rubble at the end of the war. I'd also note that Hoffmann-Axthelm, as an architectural historian, interestingly shares the profession of Jacques Austerlitz. On the topography of terror, I direct you to Franz Hofer's soon-to-be-submitted dissertation on memory sites in Berlin and Tokyo. The preceding analysis might also indicate how a writer may indeed be untimely and not resonate directly with prominent contemporaneous tendencies, even within intellectual or literary elites, but in certain ways remain close to concerns of older generations, including, to some extent, people I've mentioned, such as Kluge and Weiss. In another sense, however, Zabel's orientation bespeaks the role of a repetitive temporality, wherein what was once prominent may nonetheless return with modifications, be linked to heightened awareness or sensitivity about still active possibilities, such as neo-fascism and victimization, and have a power of address or interpolation when formulated in ways that convey an ability to disturb and provoke. Even when one is inclined, as I am, to take issue with one or another aspect of Zabel's literary or intellectual practice, such as, I would add to earlier cautions, his seeming inattentiveness to prejudicial treatment of Islamic and in particular Turkish Gastarbeiter in Germany, which we think would be a focus given his concerns, I think one might still be affected by this ability to disturb and provoke. And one may justifiably stress the crucial point that Zabel's skillful and effective deployment of stylistic devices such as repetition, parataxis, segues, and careful framing enable him to trace and render other than narrowly, quote, rational processes that escape the confines of a restricted documentary reserve that you may find in, for example, many historians and other commentators. Okay, I thank you for your somewhat flagging attentiveness, but thank you nonetheless.